and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for May 22, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, controlling blood vessel growth with microRNA, a neutron star transitioning into a radio pulsar, and detecting scientific plagiarism. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how a bird's song changes with its environment, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Ischemic diseases, such as coronary heart disease, are often due to damaged or blocked blood vessels. Growing new blood vessels, or angiogenesis, is a normal process in healing, but it can take a long time, during which more cells and whole tissues may die as a result of inadequate blood supply. In a paper published online by Science, Stephanie Demmler and colleagues have found a way to speed up the blood vessel growth by blocking a particular microRNA, MIR92A. To block the microRNA, the team created what's called an antagomer of MIR92A, or a synthetic strand of microRNA that inhibits the natural microRNA. In addition to speeding up blood vessel growth, injecting the team's antagomer into mouse models of limb ischemia and heart attack also led to functional recovery of the damaged tissues. I spoke with Demmler from her home office in Germany. Demmler is a molecular cardiologist at the University of Frankfurt.
So the study shows that if you target a microRNA, namely microRNA 92A, that this can increase neovascularization and heart function after ischemic injury.
What prompted you and your team to focus on this particular microRNA, the MIR92A?
We did initially a profiling in endothelial cells, which are the cells which form blood vessels, and identified the microRNA 17 to 92 cluster, which also comprises microRNA 92A, to be highly expressed in endothelial cells. Since these microRNA 17 to 92 cluster was assumed to regulate tumor antigenesis, we started to identify the function of each of these individual members of this cluster and assess their role for antigenesis.
How do these microRNAs do the work that they do?
So we have shown that, at least in vitro and in the endothelial cells, that overexpression of this microRNA targets several proteins, including integrin, but also vascular protective molecules such as the endothelial nitric oxide synthase. So we believe that the antagomer approach in vivo affects several targets, including integrin alpha-5, the endothelial nitric oxide synthase, as well as putative other targets which we have identified only in vitro so far.
All being very important to vascular growth.
Yes.
So if this microRNA is suppressed, then new blood vessels form?
Yes.
How did you and your team then suppress this microRNA expression?
We used antagomers, which are complementary microRNA molecules, which are initially discovered by Creutzfeldt and co-workers, and which are linked to cholesterol to make it easier for this antagomer to be taken up by cells. And these antagomers are stabilized by a chemical modification and are able to suppress the microRNAs specifically for a rather long time.
What if any side effects resulted from using this designed
antagomer
in the tissues that you and your team examined?
We, of course, looked for obvious side effects by sending the tissue to a pathologist, but couldn't find any obvious side effects. Of course, if you would go ahead with a more clinical-oriented research, you would have to study this in more detail and look specifically and for longer time points in all the different organs to exclude any toxic effects.
In which tissues did you and your team examine blood vessel growth?
We did do this in, first of all, in vitro assays, of course, where we do sprouting assays, but also in the zebrafish, in a so-called martichoke plaque model, where you study ingrowth of vessels in implanted martichoke plaques, as well as in hind limb ischemia models and in acute myocardial infarction models.
So both in vitro and in vivo?
Yes.
And in mice, zebrafish, human cells?
Human cells in vitro, but of course no human study.
Right. In the various models that you mentioned, what happened in injecting this microRNA? What were the processes and then what were the results?
What we did was, let's say it this way, we used different models. So in the zebrafish, we used overexpression of the microRNA, which was shown to disturb the vessel growth. In therapeutically relevant models, such as the hind limb ischemia or the myocardial infarction model, we used the Antagomir approach to block microRNA 92A. And in these models, ischemia-induced neovascularization was significantly augmented if we block microRNA 92A function.
Were there any differences in what happened in vivo versus in vitro in suppressing this microRNA and so promoting blood vessel growth?
We did see in both situations, in vivo as well as in vitro, an increase in vessel growth. But what we additionally could see that in the acute myocardial infarction model, also, for example, apoptosis of cardiomyocytes as well as the infarct size was reduced. And this indicates that this is really more than simply only increasing blood vessel growth.
So there's something else happening in vivo then?
Yes, in addition to neovascularization.
Is that where you and your team are going to focus next?
Yes, definitely. So we will use knockout mice where we can specifically deplete this microRNA in all the different cell lineages to identify in which cell microRNA 92A is important.
So it's likely going to be quite some time then before we see this potentially translate into a therapeutic treatment for heart attack patients or those suffering from other vascular problems.
Of course, we are very encouraged by the data in our animal models, which consistently show these effects. But clearly, one would need to study in more detail potential side effects of the Antagomir and also maybe provide Antagomirs in a clinically suitable manner. So, of course, there are some challenges before you can think about going clinical.
Okay. Stephanie Demmler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephanie Demmler of the University of Frankfurt is senior author of a paper on controlling angiogenesis with a microRNA. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Also in this week's Science, Shaped by Water. Stephen Squires and colleagues report data from the Mars rover Opportunity that show that water once helped shape an entire region of the Red Planet. Opportunity's investigation of Victoria Crater shows that the water-based processes of sulfate salt production, groundwater-influenced cementation, and alteration of outcrop surfaces under increasingly arid conditions are the same processes that also happened at Eagle and Endurance craters several kilometers away. The Opportunity rover is now headed to the Endeavour crater for further investigation, which is still another 12 kilometers away and will take the rover about 23 months to travel. It's been over 40 years since pulsars were first discovered, and scientists know little more now than they did then about how neutron stars come to spin up and begin emitting the pulsating electromagnetic radiation that gives these pulsating stars, or pulsars, their name. Now, in a paper published online by Science, Anne Archibald and colleagues report that they have found a star system in which the neutron star in the system is in the process of becoming a millisecond pulsar. I spoke with Archibald from McGill University in Montreal, Canada.
Well, normal pulsars are city-sized stellar remnants about the mass of the sun, the size of a city. They start spinning something, you know, we see young pulsars at something like 30 millisecond periods, and then they slow down gradually to out to a second, 10 seconds, and then they disappear. But there's a population of very fast-spinning pulsars called millisecond pulsars, whose periods are less than 10 milliseconds. These seem to be very old, and they seem to be spinning very quickly. And it's been something of a puzzle where they come from. We think that they come from what's called recycling. They're produced in these binary systems, X-ray binary systems, where accreting matter falls on them and causes them to spin up. And at some point, this accreting matter stops falling on them and they light up as radio pulsars. What we've found is a transition object that's just in that transition stage of turning from an accreting object with matter falling on it and emitting X-rays and not emitting radio into a radio millisecond pulsar, which emits radio and is visible as a pulsar.
And you and your team's observations of the formation of this radio pulsar cover what time frame?
Well, so it's been observed as an optical pulsar since 1952. Sorry, as an optical star. People thought it was just an ordinary star in the Palomar survey of 1952, and it's been seen now and again since then. And it was noticed as a radio source in 2002, and people looked at it, and it seemed to be an accreting white dwarf. But Thorstenson and Armstrong actually looked at it in the optical, and they found that the optical modulation, that the companion seemed to be heated on one side too much to be accounted for as an accreting white dwarf. They suggested it might be an accreting neutron star. So the system has been known for a while, but we first saw it. We did a pulsar survey in summer 2007, and in processing the data, this fast pulsar came up last fall, and we noticed that it was in the same direction as this 1023 system. And it turns out that it's actually the same system. Our orbital solution for the pulsar lines up beautifully with the existing system. And so we were able to connect this millisecond pulsar that we found just recently with this known sort of accreting system that had been in the literature. So while accretion is going on, there's actually no radio emission coming from the star. It's when the accretion stops, it's when the overflowing material runs out somehow, that you start hearing the radio emission, and it sounds something like this.
So what did we just hear?
So the first thing that we heard was, the first thing you probably noticed was a tone, and that tone is actually the pulsar's rotation period. This pulsar's period is 1.7 milliseconds, the fifth fastest known. That's 592 times a second, which is sounds like a musical tone. If you make a pulse that frequently, it sounds like a musical tone.
A D on the musical scale, or nearly.
Yeah, something like that. So what's happening is that the pulsar emits these beams of radio emission. It's from its magnetic poles, sort of directly outward, and you can picture this as something like a lighthouse sweeping around the sky. And every time it passes us, we hear a bright pulse. We hear noise from the pulsar, but it becomes stronger every time that pulse sweeps past us. And since this pulsar is spinning so unreasonably quickly, it's about the fifth fastest known, we hear what sounds like a tone. Those pulses all merge together into a tone. Now, that happens with many pulsars, but these millisecond pulsars tend to sound like tones. If we're slower, it would sound like a series of pulses. But what we've noticed about this particular pulsar is that, and you probably noticed it too, is that the tone was not constant. The frequency was constant, but it got louder and quieter and then faded out for a while and then faded back in.
Let's hear that again. Okay.
So what's going on there is, we think, that there are wisps of gas, wisps of ionized material in the system left over from when it was actually accreting, or perhaps evaporated from the companion by the blast of radiation the pulsar is firing at it. But in any case, there are these wisps of material which will occasionally drift across our line of sight and block for a moment. And so we get these brief outages of minutes. In fact, if you watch the pulsar through a full orbit, there are certain phases when the companion passes near to, but not in front of our line of sight, when we see the low frequency signals are blocked completely for minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour at a time. And in fact, as you pass into that, we see what looks like a delay in the pulses that's characteristic of sort of an increasing gas density, and then the pulses are obstructed, presumably by a higher gas density, and then they come back at the end. We're still working out the picture of this, but what it looks like is there's gas evaporated from the companion still in the system, which supports this idea that the system was accreting recently. The gas at the surface of the companion is only barely gravitationally attracted to the companion. It's easy to knock it loose and distribute it in the system.
Overall, do you and your team's observations support the consensus for how these radio pulsars are thought to form? Or is this a different explanation, potentially?
Well, the consensus is that, you know, the broad consensus is that these pulsars are formed. You've got, you know, many years of accretion in these X-ray binary systems, and then that stops somehow, and you're left with a millisecond pulsar. The problem is that somehow is a big question mark. And we are putting a data point right in the middle of that time series, if you like, where we're bridging that transition. We now have a laboratory in which people can ask questions about that somehow. So in broad strokes, I think that, yes, we do support the idea that these low-mass X-ray binaries are turning into these millisecond pulsars. We support it very strongly because we have what looks like an object that's sort of vacillating between the two as the last of the accretion tails off. In detail, though, there are a number of puzzles. For example, there's this puzzle that we see these systems that seem to be accreting and have spun up their neutron stars, in which we don't see radio, and we see millisecond pulsars, but we don't see millisecond pulsars that look like they came from the accreting systems, and we don't see accreting systems that look like they're going to turn into the millisecond pulsars when they stop accreting. So bridging that gap is a big question mark. We're not sure what goes there. And now we have a system with which to investigate it. And I think we can say that the process of tailing off the accretion is a bit more complicated than we thought it was. You know, it seems to be able to go back and forth between an accreting and a non-accreting system. We know in 1999 the system wasn't accreting. In 2001 it seems to have been accreting, and then now it's not accreting again. So it seems to be able to go through phases where it goes through episodes of accretion and episodes where there's no accretion disk at all. And that wasn't something that, as far as I can tell, has been predicted before.
Long term, is this star expected to stabilize, or the system expected to stabilize, or is there enough mass potentially in the companion for this neutron star to eventually collapse further and maybe even become a black hole?
That's a good question, because it looks like, I mean, when you have matter falling onto the surface of a neutron star, if you imagine, you know, the very strong gravity that it must have, you get extremely bright X-rays. And in fact, we didn't see really bright X-rays from this system when we think it was in its, I say, accreting, for lack of a more accurate word, when the companion was losing matter and putting it in an accretion disk. It looks like what happened was the matter was in an accretion disk, but never quite made it to the surface of the star. Like the matter was falling inward, but then being blown outward, perhaps in some kind of jets, we're not sure quite how, but was not actually reaching the surface of the neutron star. So in fact, it looks like the neutron star is not going to gain any more mass at all. On the other hand, the companion may well continue losing mass, and either through, you know, overflow and producing an accretion disk, or just plain through evaporation. And we see systems where a millisecond pulsar seems to be evaporating its companion. They're called black widow systems, because we think that eventually they'll turn into isolated millisecond pulsars because the companion has been evaporated completely and you're left with just a millisecond pulsar by itself, which is otherwise difficult to understand. But in the medium term, I mean, we know that sort of on human timescales, it's changing. That, you know, as of 1999, it was not accreting. As of 2000, it was accreting. 2001, now it's not accreting again. It could easily go through another accreting phase. And certainly if it does, we will want to observe it with all available telescopes. And so we're monitoring to see if it will do that. We've spoken to the American Association of Variable Star Observers, who, you know, it's a bunch of amateurs with CCD telescopes who look at stars that might do something interesting and make it a point of pride to report as soon as possible when one of them goes into outburst. So we'll hear if the star starts to become active again. And that could easily happen, you know, in the next few years. I mean, I won't make a prediction about when. It's obviously one of these random things, but it's obviously changing going into these episodes on human timescales, and so it could easily do so again in the near future. And if so, that will certainly be very interesting to watch.
Ann Archibald, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
Ann Archibald of McGill University is lead author of a paper on a neutron star that is in the process of becoming a millisecond pulsar. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Finding scientific papers relevant to your interests can prove to be a daunting task, especially given the growing number of scientific specialties and the tens of millions of papers already published. Automating the search with computer programs designed to look for similarities in text and content has made it easier, but it has also highlighted many instances of plagiarism. In this week's issue, Science's Jackie Grom and Jennifer Cousin-Frankel report on one of these programs, called ET Blast, and the online database named Deja Vu of questionable pairs of papers the program has found. I spoke with Cousin Frankel from her home office in Philadelphia.
Well, the story's looking at a publications database called Deja Vu that's been around for a couple years and that aims to detect duplications in published scientific papers. And they've amassed quite a number of listings in this database, about 75,000 in all. And it's become both a place for scientists to go and report suspected duplication or even plagiarism, but it's also fielded a lot of complaints from scientists who feel that they are in there incorrectly. And we just decided to really examine this thing and look at what kind of an influence it's having in scientific publishing and on researchers who publish quite a lot, what people think of it, whether it's challenging certain norms of publishing. And that's what we did.
So how did this plagiarism database get started? Who's behind it? Who's funding it?
Well, the Deja Vu database is funded by the National Library of Medicine, And it was really started by a man named Harold Garner. His nickname is Skip. And he's a computational biologist at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. And a number of years ago, he was just frustrated with our current ability to search the scientific literature and wanted to find a way to do this more efficiently. So if you were trying to look for papers in a certain field, how could you do that quickly and accurately? And with some colleagues, he created this computer program that was called ETBLAST that could essentially detect similarities in published abstracts. And that was the goal that they had. But while the original idea here was to make it much easier to just sort through millions of papers that are available online, he quickly realized that it had another potential function, which was to detect duplication and plagiarism in the scientific literature.
Still, calling it deja vu, sort of a sense of I've seen this before, may not mean plagiarism. Are there instances where it is more of a, hey, I've seen this before, but it's not plagiarism?
Oh, absolutely. I would say the vast majority of papers that are listed in Deja Vu are not plagiarism cases. And by plagiarism, we're really talking about one group that's copying another group's work. And that's a minority of cases. Right now, you know, maybe a few hundred cases out of the 75,000 or so that they've got in their database. So most of these cases, which they're still examining, involve repetition of previous articles. And a lot of those are repetition by the same group. So one group going back and maybe lifting part of what it had already published and just republishing it. And some of this might be the introduction of a paper, description of the methods, if it's a similar type of study, things like that. It could be a translation into another language. So that would be the same paper, but just in two languages. It could be a republication of a paper. There are just all different ways in which you can get this repetition in publishing, and some of them are absolutely kosher, and some of them are maybe less so. And that's one thing that Skip Garner, who started the database, is interested in.
Now, scientists copy one another all the time. The methods that they choose to use, things like that. So is really copying the language used as well, as long as they change their own data, really all that bad?
Well, I think it really depends on the extent of the copying. And in general, I don't know how many scientists are really lifting, you know, the entire introduction from another paper and then republishing it in their own paper. And I think most scientists would say that that is not considered appropriate. Now, if it's your own paper and you're copying your own introduction from a paper you published 6 months ago, maybe that's more of a gray area. But copying someone else's work is generally not looked upon favorably, though it certainly does happen. But one thing that the Deja Vu has identified and that other people have noticed as well who work at journals is this phenomenon that's known as patch writing that comes up in particular with scientists in some countries, particularly those who may not have a good grasp of English and are trying to write a paper in English. And what they will do is they will take a paper on a certain topic, let's say breast cancer, and really lift large parts of that paper, the scientific design, the introduction, other sections of the paper, and then plug in their own data. So they might run exactly the same study, but on a different cancer, and we actually did have a case like this that we describe in the story. They might run a study on a different cancer, but really just be plugging in their numbers using an earlier paper as a template. And that's something that Deja Vu has seen in several cases.
Are journals starting to use this database, Deja Vu, to check for duplication before publishing it themselves?
In some cases, yes. And one thing that Garner's group has done is they have made their computer program, ETBLAST, available. So anyone who wants to just go in and plug in, it's designed to look at abstracts, not whole papers, but anyone who wants to go in and stick in an abstract and a title from a paper and then run it against the scientific literature or really against the Medline database, which is a lot of medical and biological literature, can do that and then see if it matches up with something that was previously published. So while the Deja Vu database itself only looks at papers that have already been published, of course, someone who's running a journal could take an article that's been accepted or is close to acceptance, take the abstract and just run it through the ETBLAST computer program and see if it matches with any previously published papers. And there are some journals that are starting to do this, in particular journals that have actually had cases of duplication brought to their attention by Deja Vu and have gotten interested in ways to prevent this from happening, so to catch it before they actually publish a paper.
Now, you said that most of the papers of the 75,000 that are in the database aren't inappropriate duplications, or at least they haven't yet been tagged as such. I imagine there's quite a stigma, though, just having your own work in there.
Yes, well, I think that's sort of up for debate. There are 75,000 listings, actually, not papers. So each listing has the earlier paper and the later paper. They're published in pairs or posted in pairs on the database. And yes, most of these, something like 92% of these papers, or of these listings, I'm sorry, have only been run through the computer program. So the computer program just looks at them, and they get thrown online. And then slowly the group at UT Southwestern is going through them and trying to look at them in more detail and then recategorize them. Because some of these could just be a translation, or it could be a clinical trial that's been, you know, that's increased in size and they've run another trial, which is considered generally quite appropriate. And so certainly some of these cases are absolutely appropriate, and the people who run Deja Vu would say the same thing. But yes, some scientists, I think, do worry that there is a stigma, and even in cases where their paper has been looked at more closely and has actually been recategorized and put in a category that is considered to be perfectly appropriate repetition in publishing, they're still concerned that this could potentially impact their career. They just don't want to be associated with a database that sort of bills itself as a guardian of publication ethics if they don't feel that their publication has any ethical issues.
So some rebranding. Is Deja Vu, this project, are they making any effort to rebrand themselves as something other than the publication police? I mean, the original intent of finding papers within your own little slice of science might still be a very useful thing.
Right, and you can absolutely use ETBlast to do that, the computer program ETBlast. But I don't think that the people who, now other people may disagree with this, but I don't think that the people who run Deja Vu would say that they're the publication police. They would say they're looking for duplication and repetition in scientific publishing and trying to understand the patterns they see, both appropriate and inappropriate. And also, they're trying to get scientists and journals to think a little bit more deeply about repetition in publishing, which, as you say, is pretty natural and happens all the time, and often there's really nothing wrong with it. So I don't think, you know, their way of, they haven't tried to rebrand. What they've tried to do is create certain categories that are considered, you know, appropriate duplication, and then they have other categories that include potentially inappropriate duplication. So you can actually, you know, they would say, you can go on and you can see, you know, this is an example of an appropriate duplication. This is an example that may be more questionable.
What are the categories?
Well, there are four main categories once they've been checked by hand. And if they haven't yet been checked by hand, which is the case for the majority of papers, they're listed as unverified, but still posted online for anyone to take a look at. The categories are duplicates, which certainly include the problematic papers, although they also would include some appropriate cases, like potentially a translation that's just exactly the same as the original. Updates, which tend to be appropriate, but may also include some questionable cases. And then two that are really considered just fine are distinct papers, so papers that the computer program picked up, but that really may be different studies. For example, a dietary study that asked the same question, but one was done on men and one was done on women, so they look pretty similar, but really when you look at them more closely, they're not. Or sanctioned papers, which is another group of appropriate duplicates or appropriate repetition.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science's Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports along with Jackie Grom on Deja Vu, an online database of highly similar and duplicate citations. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. So Dave, I know one of the stories is about how a bird's song changes with its environment. How so?
Well, Rob, it turns out that birds that live in environments that are much more open, say like an open grassland or something like that, tend to have faster and more high-pitched songs, whereas birds that live more in shrubbery have slower songs that are also lower pitched. And the question going on in this study was, well, we know birds living in different environments have different tunes, but what about the same bird if its environment changes? Say over a few decades, as in this study, over 30 years, if the environment changes from, say, an open grassland to a more shrubbery environment, can the bird itself change its tune to match its environment?
Now, we're not talking about 30-year-old birds, too, but bird populations that have stayed put for 30 years.
Exactly. In this study, we're talking about a species of bird known as white-crowned sparrows.
And there are 30-year-old recordings of these birds?
Well, that was the really great thing about this study. There was a biologist, and she knew that the environment of these white-crowned sparrows had changed somewhat over the past 30 years. And these sparrows live in various locations along the U.S. West Coast. But, you know, she obviously couldn't go back in time 30 years to tape the birds back in the 1970s. And as luck would have it, there was a biologist on the West Coast who had intensively studied these birds, and he had died. But she went to his old office, dug out the tapes, and she found these 30-year-old recordings of the birds. So all she had to do was go out into the field. She took a road trip around the West Coast and record the same birds. And lo and behold, she found there was a difference in the way the song sounded after 30 years. So here's what the bird sounded like 30 years ago. And now here's what it sounds like today.
A little lower.
And a little slower. And this matches up well with how the bird's environment has changed. The biologist actually also looked at some other historical data. She looked at satellite maps from the 1970s and from today, and it confirmed that the environment of these white-crowned sparrows has become a lot more dense with vegetation. And that makes sense because their songs have also gotten lower pitched and have gotten slower, as you would see with a bird that naturally lives in this environment.
The lower pitched trill penetrates better.
That's the idea. This lower pitched trill penetrates better in a densely vegetated environment versus a higher pitched trill, which would travel farther if, say, you were in a grassland. And, you know, just as a final experiment, this biologist actually played the old bird sounds for this modern population of white-crowned sparrows.
So she played this. And the birds are used to hearing this.
Exactly. And when she played that first song, which is the older song, these modern birds didn't respond as strongly to it. When she played the newer song, some of the females, you know, danced around a little bit, and some of the male birds approached the speakers where the song was playing from. So it wasn't just that the birds had changed their tune. They knew the tune had changed.
Okay, so what else have you got with you this week?
Well, Rob, while we're speaking of time, let's travel back billions of years ago to when Earth first formed. And we're talking about 4.6 billion years ago. And this was a very violent time. First of all, you know, Earth had just formed and the solar system had just formed. So there's a lot of junk floating around the solar system.
Asteroids.
Comets, everything. And Earth started taking insults right off the bat. One of the first major things that happened to Earth was this large body in the solar system, one of these really large pieces of debris that was flying around, smacked into Earth and caused all this debris to fly off of Earth. And this debris coalesced and formed our moon. And right after that happened, so Earth is just cooling down from this really miserable experience, and Earth starts getting bombarded with all of this other debris that's floating around the solar system. It's just over the course of hundreds of millions of years, you know, comets and asteroids and other debris are just slamming into Earth's surface. And it's such a violent time for Earth that researchers refer to it as the Hadean era. Hadean as in Hades, as in hell on Earth. And the most violent part of this period occurred about 3.9 billion years ago, and it's called the Late Heavy Bombardment. That's when this bombardment was really, really strong. And scientists have hypothesized for a while that if there was any life on Earth, and some scientists have speculated that there may have been life a few hundred million years before this heavy bombardment took place, that it would have pretty much all been wiped out because this bombardment was so severe, it would have essentially sterilized our planet. And so life only picked up again, you know, millions of years after this late heavy bombardment.
So what was the study here?
Well, the study is scientists wanted to figure out, you know, is this really correct? Did this late heavy bombardment essentially wipe all life off the face of the Earth?
And so they did a simulation or something like that.
They did a computer simulation, and, you know, they tried to replicate these conditions from Earth when it was very young. And what they found was that, you know, a lot of scientists have said the reason life would have been wiped out is because when these comets or, you know, asteroids or whatever hit Earth, they caused so much heat that that they would have essentially vaporized anything down to a kilometer down in Earth's surface. But what these scientists say is actually in most of these places where these impacts would have occurred, water would have quickly rushed up from Earth's crust and cooled off the area. So things wouldn't get as hot as some scientists had speculated. They would cool down very quickly, and that would allow life to survive. And what's more, the researchers say that life could have actually existed about 4 kilometers down, which means that even when these impacts were causing this massive amount of heat, and even if this heat penetrated down as much as a kilometer, there could still be a lot of life way below the surface that would have survived.
There's evidence of life well below a kilometer down now, isn't there?
Yeah, so it's certainly possible. And what's also sort of cool about this study is that there's been speculation that one of the earliest life forms on Earth was a heat-loving organism, something that we find some of these organisms today in these deep hydrothermal vents in the sea. They live at temperatures that would scald me or you, but they seem to thrive at these very high temperatures. And what it suggests is that, you know, this wasn't obviously a time that you and I would have wanted to be on Earth, but these organisms were living in this environment that was very hot, and perhaps they were just very well suited to this environment. You know, there's all these impacts going on. Earth's surface was very hot. And it just makes sense that one of the earliest organisms might be an organism that was adapted to this way of life.
Okay, and I see you've got one more story with you. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from difficult times for a young Earth to difficult times for people with cancer. You know, there's been a lot of studies that show that people with cancer also tend to have depression. In fact, studies showed that about 60% of women with breast cancer are also depressed. And this seems to hold true for a lot of other cancers as well. And obviously, I mean, somewhat it makes sense. You know, if you or I were diagnosed with cancer, it's going to be a very heavy blow to us, and it's going to make us sad and depressed and, you know, anxious and what have you. But there's also been some speculation about, you know, is there something about the cancer itself? Is the tumor actually doing something, you know, biochemically to our bodies or to our brains that's actually causing the depression? In other words, can the tumors cause depression themselves?
The tumor's not the treatment.
The tumor is not the treatment. There's actually have been some studies that chemotherapy itself can cause depression. But, you know, this is a really hard question to answer because if I'm looking at patients that have been diagnosed with cancer, it's impossible for me to weed out the effects of the psychological burden of them being diagnosed with cancer, any sort of chemotherapy that they're undergoing, and anything that could be potentially going on biochemically with their cancer, with their tumors. So what researchers did to get around this problem in this current study was to turn to rats.
So that gets rid of potentially the psychological awareness of having cancer and the chemotherapy or treatment that they might be experiencing.
Exactly. I mean, a rat doesn't know it's been diagnosed with cancer, so it's not going to suffer the same psychological burden that we would. But the other problem is, how do you measure depression in rats? And there's established ways to do that.
Really?
Yeah, you can put a rat in a cylinder of water, and if the rat just floats instead of treading water, that's a sign of depression. Rats that are depressed also tend to eat less sugar. So there are some ways to test depression in rats. And what the researchers found was that even absent chemotherapy or the psychological burden of knowing that they have cancer, rats with tumors displayed significantly more depressive behaviors than rats without tumors when they were subjected to these tests.
Behaviors aside, was there anything else that the researchers looked at?
Well, they looked at a number of chemicals that tumors secrete. And one of these chemicals is cytokines. And there's been studies in humans that have shown that cytokines can regulate certain human behaviors. And they looked at a few other chemicals as well. And they saw this real difference in the levels of the chemicals that were present in rats with cancer and rats without cancer. So this was a further indication that maybe the cancer itself is doing something that causes depression or causes, you know, a variety of emotional states in rats and then in us.
What are other researchers saying about this?
Well, experts are excited about this because there really hasn't been much research in this area. And that's because it's, you know, as we said at the outset, it's very hard to separate all these different confounding factors when we're dealing with cancer and depression. So even though this is in rats, it really takes us a long way towards understanding how cancer can affect us emotionally.
So probably looking for a number of studies in the future with different animals and different behaviors of depression.
Exactly.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
So Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into the genetics of the bearded lady. And on the policy blog, we continue to follow swine flu. We've got a daily timeline up, so you can track what's going on with swine flu day by day. And there's also a lot of non-swine flu coverage going on. We've got a story this week about the future of CERN, which is the world's largest particle physics laboratory. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the May 22nd, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.